discussions of the self and other. We should have four people. We're missing one. That's all right. We have, let's see, Matthew Hayter, right? Presenting understanding power, power for, and power over. What can this perspective do for the sake of anarchy and social relations? We have Kaylin Stacey doing innocence and complicity in anarchist discourse. Joey Brooke Jacob doing why these strangers unequal towards a manifesto for inclusion. And if Cameron shows up, I'll introduce them as well. So does one of you prefer to go first? No, we can just go in.
Okay.
Okay, I realized that after I said what I was doing for this, I'm still working more towards that manifesto part. This is more of a why and how the stranger is unequal. Can you speak up?
Microphones are totally awkward. Okay. So I thought I'd actually start by just briefly situating myself. This is actually I'm doing a PhD, and I every day have a moment of at least a moment, if not hours, of disdain for what I'm doing and for what I'm perpetuating and what I'm trying to not have happen. And so this is. I just wanted to say that it's actually really great to actually be around a pile of my peers and people that I really respect, and get a lot of energy and encouragement from. So I just wanted to start with that. So the research that I'm about to talk about was the basis of my MA thesis. And while this project, which just finished, while this project exists mainly in the realm of academia, it gestated in my deep desires to foster better communication among people and to aid in the creation, or at least the adding to, community and consensus-based ethics. In brief, my motivations for doing this research were driven by my desire to attempt to explain, at the very least, a portion of why people are so apathetic towards those they do not directly know, those they do not directly care for, such as family or friends, those who are labeled strangers. I sought to develop an understanding by a theoretical synthesis of all the moving parts I perceived as related to the stranger. And just in brief, this is I'm very aware that I use a lot of theory, and that's not what happens in the real world, and so that's my next project, is actually real world stuff. So it bothers me. I appreciate the chuckles up here, that's good. It bothers me when witnesses see, hear, and know that something unpleasant is happening to someone, and they do nothing to alleviate the suffering of that person. So, a brief note, too, that the stranger is akin to other theoretical and real-life conceptions, those being the other, or the subaltern, or any other marginalized group. And there's distinctions, but I'm not going to go into that just yet. That's maybe for discussion or a question and answer later on. So I choose to discuss the stranger over the other terms, as to me, the stranger has better potential to represent those who are from the same place as those of the insider, or the stereotypically normative groups or groups, or group of groups. So if you have any questions about this, again, that can come up later on. So who is the stranger?
Okay, for a brief second, I'm going to try to use this without the microphone. If that door doesn't keep opening, maybe this will work, because the microphone is horrific, trying to navigate all of this.
Stand up, man.
Oh, I can... Oh, yeah. So
yeah, you don't have to hold the microphone.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the stranger is not a fixed category. The stranger is different in different situations, based upon the surrounding social aspects. The definition of the stranger is based on social relationships between known and unknown and similar and different. Individuals who possess qualities that are known or similar to our own are considered safe people. Individuals who possess qualities of unknown and difference produce feelings of fear or danger, which translate into social responses accordingly. And just a really quick note, perceptions of fear and danger of the stranger are very much social constructions. These are not things that are inherent to how we have to relate to people, but we've built these, and they're very problematic. The difference of the stranger while not being fixed is based on social aspects of comparison to those who are dominant or normative in terms of power and privilege. The stranger is strange in comparison to those who are privileged, normative, and dominant because of social inequalities, aspects of skin color, age, ability, sex, sexuality, or economic and social class characteristics. I speculate that aspects of social inequalities, as combined with neoliberalism and normative modes of processing news media, affect witnesses by projecting an okayness to not intervene when viewing a stranger in crisis. So just really quickly to reiterate, I'm using concepts of the way that we relate to each other, politics and social ties and neoliberalism, and the way that the news media will show incidents of people not responding to a stranger in crisis, and this helps normalize the way that we in our own lives, in person to people in crisis, continually not respond to them. Okay, and then really quickly, I also wanted to say that a crisis can be something as small as, you know, you witness somebody dropping their keys and not saying anything, or it can be something as big as, a violent crime that somebody witnesses and then decides not to either, even at the very least, call police or intervene on some level. And I'm not here to say that you have to sacrifice your own personal safety, but these are things we can discuss. So, individualism informs people's actions when confronted by a stranger in crisis. As the number of those with the governance wealth expands, the social fabric of community living continues to fray. A neoliberal political economic system is one that prioritizes individual economic growth and national social spending cuts. This sabotages the ability for people to have time and energy to care for each other. And as must people must continually work in order to survive. And that's a very key point, is that people really are no longer, like, people don't have the time or energy to care for each other, and I want to reemphasize that, because it's a really important part of this, is recognizing that this is, I think people want to care for each other, but there's a lot of things that hold people back, all part of this, for lack of a better word, system. People focus on worrying about themselves. Fear becomes a motivational force. We might hesitate to get involved in something we witness because of fear. The fear based on becoming a target of violence or another form of crisis. Neoliberalism projects a dog-eat-dog world, whereby the only obligation is to ourselves. For instance, family and friends, or those who we have established as being extensions of ourselves. That's what family and friends are. It's a whole other area we can talk about. Giving you so many things we can talk about. How exciting. To become a part of a crisis threatens individuality. Individuality creates and encourages a hostile environment between people in order to maintain the ideals of a neoliberal system. This fear can be extended to worry over being responsible for someone else's circumstances. A neoliberal individualist orientation is reinforced by the mass media's creation of spectacles and imaginary notions of the stranger as dangerous. So the media informs a viewer's pictures of reality, which become a kind of reality unto themselves. In this process, there is a difference between what is real and what is true. For instance, stereotypes are real, but not true. even though there are those who believe these assertions to be true and are genuinely felt. You know, they might be completely false, but people genuinely feel stereotypes. So for instance, this is how racist stereotypes come to be, as the information presented about one particular incident and the people involved is generalized to others with similar traits, and recalled later on as real. The information presented can be collected and can be recalled in the mind at a later point, for example, when encountering a person with similar social characteristics. The news story and the individuals who have read, watched, or listened to the story now have an understanding of the events as organized as these pictures of reality. The media foster ideas that circulate, repeat, and finally become the ingredients of a shared collective storehouse of political and social knowledge. When receiving messages, either through media or in person, the viewer makes meaning, and that's really important. I am not a person who's saying the media are to blame, because we receive information, we circulate it, we create our own meanings, and we're very much involved in this, and not just bystanders. The social world unwraps and explains how, why, and what we know. These are visual codes, and developing an understanding of them can appear natural, not only because we are so enveloped by them, but because we learn them so young. Visual codes are naturalized as recognition appears to be universal, having the effect of concealing coding practices and ignoring how these become habit. Visual code is not natural, but culturally specific and socially constructed. And if you haven't noticed at this point yet, I have a background in sociology, which I'm... that's a whole other topic. The mass news media help in circulating an archive of images in which the stranger is dangerous, different, and to be feared. Because these images are so available and have become expected, compassion fatigue is set in motion when individuals are confronted with the stranger in crisis. According to Susan Waller, a former journalist who now criticizes or critically examines journalistic practices, compassion fatigue is a phenomenon that occurs when the ability to care for the plight of others is impaired by one's own exhaustion in dealing with one's own life. So this is linked, I make this link to this neoliberal individualism. So these things keep like circling. The plight of others is displayed via media as a spectacle, something that is constructed, a blur between reality and make-believe. Compassion fatigue takes time to and occurs when one is repeatedly exposed to traumatic events. Think, for example, how bad news sells. We see this every day in the papers and on our news. How? When's the last time you saw like an awesome, awesome news story that didn't involve animals? At the end of the zoo. Right? And it's the cute animals like in the zoo and shit, not like in real life, but whatever. That's another topic. So exposure to traumatic events, while possibly being added to by one's own experience of trauma, can occur through viewing the trauma of others. Anxiety combines with hopelessness to disable a person from responding with action to help alleviate their experience crisis. The saturation of the suffering of others leads to the desire to shut out or deny a surrounding crisis, resulting in an actual belief that those who suffer are not really suffering, or that there is nothing that can be done to help. Media, particularly audiovisual news media, causes further exposure to trauma and crisis by the way these events are depicted, thereby disabling people from responding with desire to help those who are in crisis. News media, supposed representation of reality, is not any different than fictional portrayals of the, or in, they're not, news media is not any different than fictional portrayals in the effects on the audience, in the rousing of fear of the stranger. So perhaps news media is even more intensely promotes fear and avoidance of the stranger, as news is supposedly to recount reality. Thanks. Right, so I spent a bit of time, like I just went through a bunch of theory, and I have 2 minutes, and so I'm just spend a minute talking about one of the case studies I actually looked at, and one of them featured Hugo Kael Yaks, who was in Queens in New York just this past year. year in 2010. He intervened in a domestic dispute before 6 a.m. on an actual sidewalk. Actually, the key information, he was recently homeless. So the reason this is key information is because I understand that there might be visual cues that were given to people, which will come up in a second. But he intervened in a domestic dispute, was stabbed, the two in the couple fled. All of this was caught on a camera that was outside of this building. And it took over half an hour for somebody to stop and actually use their cell phone and call the police. But two people, there's witnesses that on the camera over the video, they saw dozens of people walk by, and one person actually stopped and lifted his body, saw that he wasn't moving and just put him down and left. And another person actually took up their cell phone and took a picture of him. I know, it's horrible. Took a picture of him and didn't actually call anybody for help. These are the sorts of things that I'm looking at, is how this comes to be, and like that disconnect, right? This person who actually used their phone but didn't call 911. I really want to find this person. It's impossible, I think, to do that. Although I just came up with an idea. Anyway, but these are things like this, again, all of this, I have all this information because it was recounted in the news media, and so we have access to this, which then, again, in reading it, the ideas of non-help circulate in our minds. So, thank you.
Wait, winner goes or what?
Winner goes.
Winner goes. So you just beat me one.
While they're doing that, can I ask the question that I ask every fucking session that we do? Yeah. Now I will be.
Just audio?
Just audio. Yeah, and maybe some memory too.
No,
that one I'm not asking for permission. I might actually beg myself to try to remember.
Have you talked to the
A lot of them have been.
Okay, so Kaylin Stacey is going to go next. Talk about innocence and complicity in anarchist discourse.
Yeah, I'm going to use the mic if that's all right. Maybe just really briefly a little bit about me. I'm an undergrad at U of T studying equity studies, but I'm not like a grad student PhD academic in the sense that I'm a professor, and I don't actually identify as an academic, more as an organizer, but I am attempting to apply theory to the organizing that I've done and that my friends do. And in that way, help us all improve. But this presentation is really just the beginning of an exploration into a topic and not the outcome. So my hope is really to provoke conversation and reflection and not to tell you what I've learned or something like that. In this presentation, I'm hoping to apply some anti-racist and feminist writing, specifically that of Shireen Razak, Mary Louise Fellows, and Sarita Srivastava, to anarchist conceptions of self and morality and how we kind of construct our being in the world and in our communities. Important in their writings are the concepts of innocence and the moral positioning of the subject, which I actually didn't think that I was talking about until I started to sit down and write this out. But that's what I'm doing, and complicity in oppressive systems. I guess maybe I'll start by actually quoting Shireen Razak, who has done a lot of really good work and is really like someone that I really respect in terms of theorizing social conditions. One of the things that she said about innocence is that the challenge in radical education that we currently face becomes how to build a critical consciousness about how we as subjects position ourselves as innocent through the use of such identity markers as the good activist or just the good person in general. As long as we see ourselves as not implicated in relations of power or as innocent, we cannot begin to walk the path of social justice and to thread our way through the complexities of power relations. So that's where I'm starting. Innocence, complicity, morality, that's kind of what I'm hoping to talk about. There's a joke that I've heard that anarchism exists as an ideology, so white guys can feel as oppressed as everybody else. It's kind of a problematic joke. I think there are a lot of different ways that we could pick that apart, but it does rest on like this tiny sliver of truth that though we collectively theorize the ways that we are complicit in the oppression of others through privilege or the way that we the actors or such things, that we tend not to feel this privilege as intensely as we do feel our own victimization through whatever social processes most directly affect us. This is reflected, I think, even in the way that we talk about privilege as something that we receive rather than something that we actively live. In the way that we don't do the same thing with oppression. Razak discusses this as the race to innocence, where from different social positions we come to believe that our own subordination and domination is the most urgent and that we are unimplicated in the subordination of others. Innocence is basically the feeling of non-contribution to oppression, which is built on the idea that if we are against oppression or resist in some way that we actually become non-complicit in those systems. For example, the idea that we can be not racist and therefore be good people and not part of a relationship of power with somebody else. Fundamentally, the notion of innocence is one that is removed from a relationship of power in which, you act out and actually participate in. And this notion of innocence erases hierarchical relationships that exist in our society. It's been discussed by Sarita Srivastava as a characteristic of liberal national discourse, and part of the creation of national mythologies that erase genocide or other oppressions, as in Canadian colonial discourse, for example, which we heard a little bit about in the last session, where kind of Canadian discourse routinely decries the kind of the colonial past while maintaining the innocence of white settlers and like the constantly welcoming and inclusive contemporary environment. While innocence is primarily theorized by these thinkers as like a liberal discourse, I think there are several ways that it does apply to anarchist discourses as well, knowing that there are many and that I won't actually tackle them all. Anarchism has long been involved in the creation of alternative spaces, politics and ethics, which Foucault described as heterotopia, but which we just normally talk about as alternatives. The spaces which are constructed with a constructed counter-hegemonic morality. These imagined moral communities of social movement organizations or anarchist communities, Srivastava talks about social movement organizations and feminist organizations, but I'm basically just kind of replacing social movement with anarchists, are concerned not only with the production of ethical practices and values, but also concerned with the production of ethical selves. One of the impacts of these heterotopic spaces is a heavy, morally saturated atmosphere in which the ethical self or the good activist is seen to be free of racist, sexist, or otherwise oppressive tendencies, and is not supposed to exist in that space. This often means that as activists and anarchists, we are actually participating in the race to innocence rather than being open about our own complicity and being honest about the ways that we actually act this out. This carries with it many discursive elements I would argue are counterproductive to the goals of our movements, namely the dismantling of systems of oppression. when innocence becomes a marker of our identity, we simultaneously, or it provides us with the opportunity to simultaneously covet it, as well as turn it into a weapon to use against others or seek defense from, in kind of an atmosphere where morality and complicity can be used against us as charges that affect only us and not our communities in general. This is one reason why there's a great deal, I would say, of fear, dread, or kind of like emotion-based, like negative emotion associated with discussions of racist, sexist, ableist tendencies or other tendencies among white anarchists, among male anarchists, etc. We feel defined by being an activist with clean hands as opposed to being activists who exist in relationships in which we are more powerful than, or carry more privilege than people that we work with. Emotion-based responses are common, and Srivastava goes into a lot more detail about them, but they can generally be used as essentially as deflections from admitting that we live within these relationships. And I would argue that often these responses, based on announcing our hatred of oppression, that we are seeking to escape from the relationships in which we are bound to, in which we are actually like stuck in relations where oppression informs our lives, and acting in roles that subordinate others informs our lives. I would also argue that in doing so, we actually cut ourselves off from possibilities of sincere solidarity and of expanding the scope of what anarchism means to different communities, and in the end of effectively dismantling the effects that unjust social systems have as they play out in our daily lives. I'm going to give several examples of what I'm talking about, like not completely specific, but just examples of the types of things that can occur in such. I'm going to label it as the climate of fear and like emotion based response to discussions of anti-racism, or anti-oppression. One of the things that I've seen and experienced and participated in myself is, I guess, a tendency to enact like a shifting the blame defense mechanism, whereby, like oppressive tendencies in like that are enacted by a specific person become that person's individual oppressiveness, and in doing so, demonizing a person and situating yourself as innocent in comparison, as not part of the same process or not as someone who acts the same way. In doing so, kind of delegitimizing the systemic nature of, or the discursive nature of these systems and individualizing them in specific people. It's done in a way that can suggest that the moral code we should be operating by is that we're pure, and that people who don't live up to that should not be part of alternative spaces, which I don't think is actually like I'm not saying that as an idea that critique and criticism is not important, but just to question the motivations behind the way the critique is engaged sometimes. I would say that it's maybe controversial, but that what we've actually constructed in such like a morally dominated space is that our spaces, instead of being free from domination, are dominated by fear, and that this climate of fear produces unspoken motivations for anarchists, who, in an attempt not to be perceived as complicit, but rather innocent, because complicity is death knell, or our identities are so closely tied to being innocent that being open and honest about the ways that we actually live these things can be really difficult. One example, I was having a conversation a while ago with a friend of mine, someone on the subject, and she said to me, one of the things that she has noticed that we do generally, like in community organizing, that we never talk about, but that many, many people feel, is, for instance, being in a group, being in a meeting or in a group discussion, and constructing an anti-racist argument or a feminist argument, and not necessarily noticing it, but feeling at the end of the discussion like you're really hoping that, for instance, a woman or a person of color will come up to you and say, "That was really a wonderful thing that you said." You know, all of these other men, they're pretty sexist, but not you. You really understand. I think it's a weird thing to think about someone actually saying, but I think when she said this, it completely resonated with me as something that I feel probably all the time. And as hoping that I'm actually not participating in things that I do participate in, and that I'm not part of relationships of power. I think that there are many other ways that plays out, and that's just one example. The result of that occurring is that when we become so emotionally attached to the idea of being innocent, much of our political organizing becomes about protecting ourselves and our reputations from each other, rather than focusing on the systemic patterns and the repetitions of oppression that continue to perpetuate within our communities. I don't have any solutions in conclusion, which I have to make now, but I'm hoping that people, like people in the audience, or have thoughts as to what, you know, or in what ways we can make our communities less about being innocent, more about, you know, fighting back.
I think this will actually have. I'm going to try and not use the mic, so if I can't hear me, then I'll stand up. But I'm also going to try to sit down first of all. I think actually what I'm trying to say here will have a lot to do with what Killen was just talking about. So even just some of the examples he used were already very similar to examples that I was going to try and come up with in what I'm talking about. I'm going to try and also be, like, I'm, as a situation of myself, I spend far too much of my time thinking, probably. There's a lot of academic guilt that has been going around this weekend, and I'll run in my lot of that. And one thing I actually tried to do here is to not use any of it. So I'm not going to reference anyone. I was trying to actually formulate a way of talking about some stuff that can always become more complicated in a very simple way to provoke a sort of challenge. And so I'm also trying to be somewhat controversial in that one of my main claims here is that Every time we enact what we call a power for ourselves, we're always dominating something. There's always some form of domination that goes with any kind of empowerment, and what we have to be able to deal with is actually constructing what kind of domination that we want that to be. We obviously don't want it to be certain types of domination. But I'm trying to suggest that we have to accept that every time we do anything, we're going to be dominating something or other, and face that so that we can construct the ways that we want to do it as whoever we are, if we're anarchists, whatever. That can lead back into what the distinction that I'm going to use here, which is actually one that I was trying to take from the most general contexts. So in organizing settings, in non-academic contexts, I've often encountered this way of talking about power as differentiated between power for and power over. So those are the terms that are in the title of what I'm talking about, where power for refers to a sort of your capacity to act on something, right? So we normally associate that power for with ourselves at an individual level, where we're empowered to be able to do this or that. Whereas power over, we associate with oppression, exploitation, all of these things which we fight, want to fight against. And normally we associate that with more structural or institutional scenarios as well. And then there's also, some of this comes from Starhawk. She also adds a third, which is power with, which I'll sort of come back to. But we're going to try and work generally with the two distinctions to begin with. I'm going to try and work against the notion that power for and power over are two separate things. Okay, so we normally treat them this way, even in an untheoretical manner. We act as if we can empower our own activities in a way against power over, against the overpowering of other structures, and in a way where we can get over exerting any kind of power over in our own power for, right, in our own environment. And basically, you might even say that this is at the core of what anarchism as a doctrine or as a praxis tries to actually accomplish. So you can see it, especially in the classical anarchists, when they talk about the state, right? So there's often talk about the state as if it's some sort of purely unnatural form of power over. And if we can smash out all those bits, we'll come back to a sort of natural place where we can all act with some kind of freedom, some kind of naturally unoppressive way of being empowered. So they're separated off like that. And we act like this tactically, right? We treat things as sources of oppression, which we have to fight. If we can get through them, then we maybe will be innocent at the end, right? So this notion that we can come up with some kind of pure power for is very, very associated with what Caitlin was talking about in terms of searching for that kind of innocence, searching for that kind of space where we can not be oppressive in any way at all. So two challenges I wanted to make to this model. One is, I guess, what I was just saying, is that we associate power for and power over as being two separate things. They come from different directions. They're not necessarily associated with one another. There can be power over, as in an oppression or a domination, that doesn't have anything to do with power for, and we can be empowered for ourselves, for our own activities, without having anything to do with oppression of power over. That's the first thing that I think I'm trying to challenge. The other one is associated. It's that power can come from a source. So normally in anarchist and liberal doctrine, we have this idea of individual power, where people have their own power to act out of some sort of natural freedom, right? As if you're the source of some kind of power. And if we put this on the other side, we also treat the state as if it can act as if it has the power to act, as if the actions of the state come from its essence or its identity somehow. Okay, so the notion that power starts from a point or from an actor, from an agent, is also linked in with the notion that they're separate. We can challenge both of those things. And I'm going to try and do it very generally. This is not actually a causal argument in any way, but I just wanted to run through quickly talking about what power counts as in physics and biology. Because in general, and obviously these things are contestable in those disciplines as well, but you can see the general sense of how power is thought of in physics and in biology goes completely against those two premises. Okay, so, for instance, the law of thermodynamics, I forget which one, the third maybe? Second? Someone may know. That energy is not created. Right? You can't create energy, you can only transform it. You can change its shape, you can change its direction, you can change its matter, but you can't create energy. Okay, so this goes against the sense of power, right? So I just substituted the word energy for the word power, right? So we can use the word power then. Power cannot be created. It can only be directed, formed, inhered in things, transferred, etc., right? So in that sense, there's no agent of power, right? Power always comes through things. And also, when you're talking about the physics of moving objects at the simple level, there's always force and counterforce. Right? That's the way it's explained. So that you have, in order to push an object, you need to push back in the other direction. Right? And so, this is also coming to the point where I'm actually trying to suggest that in order to exert any kind of power for, you have to push back. Something has to be overpowered in order to give power to something else. And so this is a little bit of a different sense. We can also think of this connection in more of a structural or the way that Foucault would talk about it. And I just broke my rule. I didn't talk to that. But it's often, I'll take it back.
But he mentioned Starhawk before.
Some bald guy sometimes said that, right, so there's often the sense in which we talk about power and resistance as going together. So our resistances are locked in with the way that power is structured in society. We can talk about that too, and it works in the same formulas, but I'm actually talking more in the sense of, well, I guess, in the way that when you make a certain empowerment, when you act in a certain way, you're always taking energy from something else to do that. And so that's in a general sense of physics. That's the first example. It actually makes even closer sense when we talk about it in terms of biology, because you can basically think of how do you power an organism. Right? Every organism takes energy from something else, right? So living things eat other things, they destroy them, they overpower them, and incorporate them, and that's how you stay alive, right? So in a biological sense, there's no such thing as this kind of self-generated power, right? You can't, there's no perpetual motion machine. Well, I guess that's working back to physics, but there's no perpetual life machine, right? You have to eat other things, you have to take them and turn them into what is going to be your power. Right? Every organism does this. So that works in both of the two senses of the things I'm trying to challenge. That there's no agent of power, that it's actually always flowing through. So you take your energy from something else, and then it gets expended into something else again. And that to make power for, you're always overpowering something. So, again, I'm not trying to say that these are causal arguments, to say that power therefore works this way in human social relationships. They're just easy ways for me to blow through and give good kind of conceptual ways to imagine what it is I'm trying to talk about. So if we're talking about this in politics, in human relations, what implications does it have to consider power in this way? So that's the open question that I'm going to try and put out there. I think that actually to consider power in this way is much more useful for what would count as anarchist studies, for doing thinking about our social relationships, our relationships of power, in an anarchist way for anarchist purposes, for anarchist ways of relating. At least because it means that we have to accept a sort of collective responsibility for how we organize our power. We can't just work on the fantasy that we can destroy power and replace it with power. Right? We would destroy power over, replace it with power for. It's a fantasy of innocence. And so, in order to deal with that, then, it comes through in this very sort of problematic claim, though, that I'm also sort of saying that we can't help but be oppressive in some sense. We can't help but dominate, we can't help but overpower in order to empower the way that it is that we want to be. So that sounds like a very un-anarchist thing to say, right? So that's part of the challenge here. And the challenge in that is, I think, what I would claim is that there's as many different ways to overpower as there are different ways to organize a culture. Right? There's as many different societies as are possible as ways to organize what counts as your power over pushing into your power form. And we have to take a certain responsibility in formulating the way that we're going to articulate our power over. So we're going to overpower something. How we do that, we know certain ways we don't want to do that. We can see them in the way that our culture acts, right? In the way that racism, sexism, statism, capitalism, right? All of our isms, we have names for those ways that we don't want to formulate our own power. But we have to look at the way that we do need to avoid those things. And as long as we pretend that that we can get to some sort of pure, innocent space, we're not going to be able to do that. So, I have to hurry into the last parts. So to note what I'm calling this other model, one thing that I would claim is, to work back in Starhawk's third term, is that every power for, power over complex, you get them together, every one of them is a power with. So that destroys the agent of power. Everything is collective, right? So in an anarchist sense, we have to make that as a collective construction of how we are organizing our empowerment, both for our struggles against other forms of power and for our self-figurative ways of creating, you know, what our power wants to be. One of the examples, cases of how I think this is can be a functional way of looking at things, because, you know, I've just built this sort of strange abstract idea, but I'm trying to apply it. So in the way in the work that I do, my thinking work anyway, normally trying to think about how our communicative relationships work. So how do we organize power in decision making, in in our practice of community, in the practice of struggle against enemies, etc. So one thing, I think, I'll just give an example. I have a couple examples, but I'll run out of time, so I'll try and give as many as I can. Is that you have to recognize then that every institution has its complex. It's something it's trying to empower, and something in some manner in which it overpowers in order to accomplish that. Wherever you see someone or something that has the claim that it's only one side or the other, then, like, red light, mm-hmm. right? So, for instance, when people claim that they are not expressing power over in any way, that they're being like, well, this is just my empowerment, this is the pure form of my power for, that's someone who needs to check their privilege. That's someone who is not accepting a certain structural position in which they are necessarily organizing some kind of over power. That's going to be a place where we're going to get tyrannical ideology. Right? That's Stalin talk. To put it at the grandiose level. Right? I mean, it happens all the time. It happens with people you talk to everywhere. And on the other hand, when you see some place where someone calls out something as being only power over, as only oppressive, you got to watch that. How are we functioning in terms of demonizing this other thing, right? You get a demonizing effect, which was part of what Caitlin was talking about, where those two things end up supporting each other too, right? The sense of being like, my power four is the pure and the right kind, and you have a demonized other half of that, which is cut in half, right? So when we cut those things in half, we fixate on those things, and we do this in our social analysis as well. We do it really easily, right? We blame some sort of institution or some sort of action, and we call it, like, that's power over, and we just need to kill it, and we can do it because we have the right power form to do that. But those things, they're wrapped up together. So, there's sort of just an example. You got to check those things because it'll be very ideological wherever you see them split in half. There's my example. Time's up.
Can I have a quick camera shot? Did it show up? Okay, thank you. Then we can move into question and answer. We don't have a whole lot of time because we got started about 15 minutes late, but thanks to camera not showing up, we do have some time. So let's start where I stopped.
I'm sorry, you get everyone's name. First speaker,
Joey.
So you were talking about how people respond to strangers in some kind of crisis situation going on from that. It seemed to me, if I understood you correctly, you seem to be almost equating individualism as constructed by capitalism and neoliberalism and so on, and individuality as almost equal. The way I see it is individuality is just based on different people having different inclinations, talents, tastes, whatever, and that in no way is the same thing as the whole ideology of being focused on yourself to the detriment of other people. I was just wondering if you meant that or what you were saying.
I'm not sure that I'm totally clear on what you're saying. I'm not, from what I'm taking, but from what I'm understanding that you're saying, I wasn't commenting on people's individual, what was the word you used, abilities or talents? You didn't use those words.
Well, it seemed, to me that's what individuality means, but it seemed that you were equating individuality, at least the word, with individualism.
Okay, they're not the same. No, individualism is a situation that I'm not tying into being like the neoliberalism created. This has existed for a long time, and I'm not about to go into the history of how that happened. It just is exacerbated by it. But also that it's more of an issue of how people disregard others and have concern for themselves more than other people.
Because I thought you used the two words interchangeably.
No, I just had a term called neoliberal individualism, which is a comment just about a type of individualism.
Because I thought you said individuality.
No.
And can I just make a quick comment about the last speaker, Matthew? If I understood you correctly, you seem to be saying that any time someone is exerting power,
it is having power over someone else. And that's interesting. I'm not sure what to think about that. It reminds me of something that I used to hear sometimes about 20 years ago or more. In certain circles, I remember, because all your talk about power and energy reminded me of this. In certain circles, I used to hear sometimes it said that bisexual women were taking energy from women and giving it to men, and that was being used as a criticism. And I mean, it could be the other way around, even, but it just reminded me of that.
That sounds wacky, but yeah, I don't know, right? Like, it depends on the social scenario in which that's happening. It might be true, but I guess to respond to part of it, it's not necessarily that any person's empowerment necessarily takes away from someone else's, right? Like, it's not even only on the level of between different people. So, like, to be empowered yourself, for instance, we normally take this as a form of discipline, right? You discipline yourself into being powerful in a certain way. And that's exerting a certain power over yourself, over your body, over your actions, and so on. In many cases, exerting a certain kind of self-empowerment does take power away from other people in particular social scenarios. So the question, though, is how can we alter that, maybe, right? Because you could also be empowered with those same other people if you reformulated the way that empowerment worked for you and for the group that you're in. So, yeah, the point is generally that there always will be some form of overpowering, but it's not at all fixed where that's going to happen.
I really liked what you were talking about. So often I find that within politics there's a black and white scenario between things, and I think that kind of relates to what you were talking about in the sense of how we see it ourselves as like, like the most humanitarian people around or whatever. And that's a problem because we forget how easy it is to be oppressive. I mean, for years, I always thought that like I had like all my stuff covered and or whatever, and not realizing that I was just as much a part of oppressing certain people and for different things. But I think that we forget about our internal hierarchy and our egos, and how this kind of speaks to what you were talking about, how like we look for credit, because I think we're all kind of afraid of just washing away into the background in our own personal selves. But this movement needs to happen, and we need to contribute to it and feel happy that we've put our hand in it, not our entire selves. And like, there's a real fear of mine that like one day there'll be something along the lines of like an anarchist party to some degree. I mean, like, or like we'll start looking to one individual within the movement that will lead all of us, and it's that kind of like messiah complex that I'm really, really worried about. That like we have to gear away from that. We have to like, I don't know. It's more of a comment than a question.
We are running short on time. I saw two hands so far. I'll take both of them at once, and then get the response. And we'll see what time it is. A person in the back, Sonny Q.
Yeah, I really appreciate the conversations that we were having today, especially because I am a woman of color, and for me, I don't just get to theorize what you, like, that's not something that's an afterthought for me, that's something that I live and experience all the time, having to think about these things. It's not just like an afterthought, like, oh, well, maybe like I should start thinking about the ways in which I'm complicit in oppressions, and I do that too because there are a lot of privileges that I do have. But for me, it's not a choice to not feel those power dynamics, even within these communities. Like that's, and like a lot of the time, I feel really alienated in anarchist spaces, especially like when they're occupied by a lot of white bodies and a lot of
male bodies. And what's really frustrating to me is that there isn't that transparency a lot of the time. When we talk about how we're all oppressed, we talk about the single monolithic oppression, and a lot of it is like a class oppression. We don't talk about the ways in which, you know, white supremacy and sexism and like ableism is very much a part of that experience. We aren't honest about it, and like nobody should feel guilty about the privileges that they have, but people should be honest about it. And like part of what I see happening, like constructive ways to do that, is to be very honest about where you're coming from and say, okay, as a white person, I experience these privileges. As a male-bodied person, I experience these privileges. That doesn't make me a bad person, but recognizing that, you know, in a lot of these spaces, people will more likely listen to me. People will more likely, you know, like, give me credit. I'm more comfortable talking. Like, even for me right now, it's really scary talking because I'm a woman and I'm a person of color. Recognizing that just to be able to speak and to not have that same kind of fear is a privilege. And like even recognizing that privilege and being like, okay, I recognize that I'm talking more, I'm going to step back. It's not a bad thing to have privileges, but it's good to be very transparent about that. And it's very good to be transparent about who, when we talk about who we're like our struggle, who is our struggle. Usually when we say our struggle, we're silencing a lot of people who come from different positions when we use like blanket statements like that. Like, people just need to be more transparent about what they're coming from, where their privileges are, and people shouldn't feel guilty about it, but people should be honest about it, because when people kind of hide under, like, the anarchist label, there's no room for criticism, there's no room for self, like, there's no room for dialogue, and a lot of the time, people of color, women, disabled people, you know, we feel, like, excluded from those spaces, and, like, we just have to be critical of, like, why aren't there as many people of color speaking, why aren't there as many, like, women speaking, like, and, like, just be very honest about what those reasons are. That's what I'd say.
I just wanted to, I guess it's a statement, maybe there's time to respond, maybe there isn't, that there's sort of different levels of control that people might feel they have in certain choices they make or situations, like the types of person-to-person dynamics that we've been largely talking about here that aren't necessarily mediated by sort of an economic exchange. So exactly the sort of relations that you were talking about and the way people might manifest privilege or not, or manifest oppression, being oppressed, that kind of thing. Then there's sort of immediate economic relations that somebody might have where they choose to, say, make their breakfast before they come to the conference or go to a restaurant, whether they choose to tip the waiter or not, those types of sort of immediate economic relations. But then there's sort of the more sort of direct, the less direct economic relations where we feel like we might have the least control. For instance, if you just sort of take the microphone as a commodity, the fact that it was sort of probably mined by people in Brazil at the point of the gun, it may have been assembled in China by child labor and moved around the planet during its assembly by energy from a expropriated indigenous land from the tar sands or Indonesia, places like that. So that's where we might feel like we have the least control, and it doesn't have to do with whether you use the mic or not today. It's more sort of the fact that there's a mic and we live in capitalism and that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, it's not good to feel guilty about these things or feel paralyzed, worst of all. But, you know, to feel, I guess like Chris Dixon said yesterday, like you, in your work, you're responding to the social movements and oppressed people who, you know, are part of these sort of systems, and that you take responsibility in your writing or your speaking or your interactions with people around those things and feel like, okay, I'm going to deal with this by talking about it, researching it, learning about it.
Technically, we're out of time, but the next is the breakout sessions, so I don't think anything else is going on in this room, so if people do want to hang out and continue this conversation, are you sure that would be okay? But if people want to take in the breakout sessions, I'll give people time to hang out.
And where is it?
Here, I don't know exactly where.
I'll be here.
Yeah, I imagine where the